My guest today is James Corbett. And James, what's going on in the world right now, do you think, with Schwab resigning and the Pope dying and all this other stuff? What's happening?
Oh, I don't know. There's not really much passing through the news wires these days, is there? Not much to comment on. You know, I will comment on the Klaus Schwab story, if only because I think it vindicates what I've been saying for several years now, which is that Klaus Schwab is nothing more than a carnival barker who is barking for his particular brand of globalism through his particular organization. And the World Economic Forum was never the agenda setter for the entire globe. And with whether Klaus Schwab is the head of the WEF or out of the WEF, whether he's being accused of Me Too or whatever is happening right now, doesn't really matter in terms of the overall agenda of the people who are really running this show. I don't think Klaus Schwab was really the one who was ever calling the shots. And I think the fact that he's going down so spectacularly like this is just another indicator of that.
So you think that these are the same old ideas and they just keep getting rebranded with new names and nothing really changes? The WEF, if that were to go away, it was the Bilderberg before that?
And Bilderberg is still around, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, but most people probably haven't heard of it. It's a much more exclusive organization than Davos and the World Economic Forum. Davos, every year, you know, thousands of people end up congregating there, and they have open sessions, and there's a lot of press coverage. Bilderberg, however, has been meeting every single year almost every single year since 1954, under complete secrecy, to the point where even the existence of the Bilderberg Group was denied, and people were called crazy for even believing that it existed until the early 2000s, at which point it became undeniable that 150 to 200 of the most richest and powerful and influential people in the world, royalty, heads of state, sitting members of parliament and Congress, captains of industry, captains of finance, all meeting in one location in a 4-star hotel resort within driving distance of a national capital, either in Europe or North America, every single year, not covered by any media whatsoever, until it became undeniable because of the advent of online media actually covering the Bilderberg Group. And wouldn't you know it, suddenly the Bilderberg Group comes out. Yes, we exist. They have a website now, bilderbergmeetings.org, so you can go and see their official agenda every year and their official attendee list. And there may be a few people who attend that they don't put on that attendee list. But anyway, that being what it is, it's all out in the open now. And yet it still receives almost no press coverage whatsoever. So I think you might be a little bit closer to the seat of power when you look at a group like the Bilderberg Group.
Do you have an idea of what the next brand name is? If the WEF does fade away, is there something waiting in the wings that everyone will talk about?
It is an excellent question in one sense, because I am sure there will be another organization that sort of takes the public spotlight like that. But again, I don't think that's necessarily indicative of anything, because as you said earlier, and I'll just reiterate that, I think that it's the same ideology that's being propounded through various different groups. And some groups may be more popular than others at any given moment, but the ideology itself is, I think, what we have to be worried about. So whether it's Klaus Schwab telling us to eat the bugs, or it's Bill Gates, or it's anyone else, I think it's the same message.
So I like to think of myself as awake, but I just watched your two docs, or part one and part two of your Big Oil docs. I totally love those. And you do a great job of going back through the history of some of this stuff, eugenics and what transhumanism is that the correct word?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, so it's really helping me see the big picture here and how the whole climate thing that we're seeing right now, it ties into the rest of it, correct?
There is absolutely a continuity of agenda. Just as these groups come and go and they get cycled off the stage, I think the agenda itself continues to go under different guises and under different names. And ultimately, it really boils down to something simple, something that I think everyone can grasp immediately, is that the rich and powerful want to consolidate their power in as few hands as possible. And what is the best way to do that? The only way to truly control a society, to really control a society, is to get people to believe that there is a reason why you are in charge. Not just to accept the fact that you're in charge, but to believe that for some reason they have to follow your orders. And thousands of years ago, there was a very simple explanation that was given that everyone could understand immediately. The pharaoh is a god on earth, and that's why you listen to him. That idea started to develop as people maybe started to question and become a bit skeptical. I'm not sure that is a god. So, for example, in China, that they had the mandate of heaven. So a given ruler would have the mandate of heaven and when everything is going well in the empire. But when things start to, when there's calamities and droughts and floods and war, well, clearly he's lost the mandate of heaven. So then you have an internal war to find a new ruler. The Europe, of course, had the divine right of kings. No, God appointed this family to rule over you. It's not that they are gods. It's just that they have been appointed by God to rule over you. Of course, by the time we get to the 19th century and post-Enlightenment, well, we're not going to go with that, you know, mumbo jumbo anymore. We need some scientific, rational basis for why certain people are allowed to rule over other people. And wouldn't you know it, the late 19th century gentleman scientists of Britain decided, well, people like the wonderful late 19th century British gentleman scientists are designed and best to rule over others because they're protoplasm, or they didn't even have a term for the mechanism of heredity at that time, but they coined the term eugenics to describe why there's just something about our family stock, our line, that is better than yours, and that makes us rightful rulers of humanity. We should spread, we should have big, healthy, flourishing families, and the poor and the indigent and criminals and others, they are poor because they have poor genes. Therefore, they need to be eliminated from the gene pool one way or another. Sterilization, for example, became quite popular in state after state after state in the U.S., and those exact same sterilization laws were then transplanted over to Germany that consciously copied those sterilization laws. But of course, the whole Nazi Germany World War II thing kind of tainted the idea of eugenics in the mind of the public. So it had to adopt a different form. The same idea. There are people who deserve to rule over you because they're better, but it had to be refined. And so we started to see the exact same institutions and people that were funding the eugenics movement suddenly started funding the population, overpopulation scare. So you get, for example, the Rockefeller family was foundational in funding eugenics in America in the early 20th century. And of course, also funding Nazi eugenics. The Kaiser Wilhelm Institute was funded by the Rockefellers, for example. But then once that all got tarnished, you get John D. Rockefeller III founding the Population Council in the exact same office where the American Eugenics Society used to be. They essentially just changed the name on the door. It went from the American Eugenics Society to the Population Council. And suddenly the big hand-wringy problem is, oh, there's too many people on the planet, so we need to find a way to reduce the population, which, wouldn't you know it, is exactly the same thing the eugenicists were talking about. Huh, funny coincidence. And so you get this hand-wringing about too many people and what can we do and sterilization and all of these sorts of problems at the exact same time that a number of environmental and conservationist organizations started solidifying and incorporating. So, for example, the World Wildlife Federation, founded by card-carrying avowed eugenicists, people like Julian Huxley, who not only was a British Eugenics Society director for many years, a president of the British Eugenics Society, he was also the founder of UNESCO. And in the founding document of UNESCO, he wrote that part of the purpose and philosophy of UNESCO was to make eugenics a politically viable idea, to make it popular again, essentially. And these are the types of people that founded the environmental organizations that then took that population scare and started to morph it into the carbon scare. Oh my God, it's carbon dioxide that is killing Mother Nature, and there's too many people making too much carbon. So what we're going to have to do is limit and ration your carbon. And by those means, I guess we have to limit and ration the, you know, human population, and you have to live in a hovel and eat bugs in order to appease the weather gods, while, of course, your superiors fly jet off in their private jets to their conferences, etc. So it's the same thing that has woven its way throughout human history, really, but it just takes different forms in different eras. And in the current era, it is technocracy. This idea that we need to be ruled by experts. Who can possibly disagree with that? We do need to be ruled by experts. They know what's best for us. But the interesting thing is, technocracy is not just some sort of word that came out of the ether. It was a specific movement that was founded in the 1920s. It was incorporated as Technocracy Inc. in the 1930s by a charlatan named Howard Scott, who lied about all his credentials and managed to somehow set up in the basement of Columbia University, and M. King Hubbert of Hubbert's Peak. People know, of course, Peak Oil, the entire Peak Oil hypothesis coming from this Shell geophysicist who also was a founding member of Technocracy. And the technocratic idea laid out in this technocratic study course that you could go and download and read for yourself, was this elaborate idea of getting rid of nation states, governments. We don't need presidents and that sort of thing. No, what we'll have is these technocratic experts, statisticians and scientists who will precisely calculate the energy inputs and outputs of the entire economy so that they can absolutely perfectly balance them, so that there will be no booms and busts. There will be no craziness, you know, none of this depression and boom cycles. It will be perfectly balanced because the scientists will know absolutely every single item that will need to be produced in all of society. They will know exactly how many joules of energy it will take to create each item. And they will take that massive energy budget for the entire technate, not nation, it will be the technate of North America. And they will partition that out and divide it up between the population. And they will hand out energy credits. And you will use those energy credits to buy things at the store. That will be the new currency. You'll have however many joules of energy for the month. And once you're out of your joules of energy allowance, well, that's it. And you won't have any more. And fast forward to the 21st century. I mean, think about that in the context of the 1930s. It's insane. It's absolutely bonkers that they would have even thought of such an idea in the 1930s, literally keeping track of every single item in the economy in real time, how it's being sold, to whom. Absolutely unfathomable. But, you know, in 2025, actually, that's quite doable. I mean, we have databases. We can track all of these things. All we need to do is to find some sort of way of rationing this out in terms of energy. Oh, how about carbon credits? Oh, I see. We can start to essentially take the exact technocratic playbook, but use it in the 21st century with this overlay of the carbon scare and manage society that way. And unfortunately, so many people are historically illiterate, do not know where this is coming from, cannot comprehend that there are forces at play that are not actually working in their best interests. So they go along with it. And people start, I guess, eating the bugs to appease the weather gods. And here we are.
So there is this whole plan to use central bank digital currency to implement this whole thing. They keep track of exactly how much gas you bought in a month, all that stuff. And if you buy too much, you're done, that type of thing. How close are we to that actually being rolled out? Like, the EU is trying to roll it out, aren't they?
They are. They're talking about the digital euro, for example. Yes, absolutely. And unfortunately, I think there's a sort of game that can be played with the terminology around this, because you'll see that, for example, in the United States, there are a number of senators and others who are trying to propose ideas for stopping. There will be no CBDCs in the U.S. But what about PBDCs, private bank digital currencies, may not be any better than the central bank digital currencies, because the idea of a central bank digital currency is that it is a claim of the central bank liability, which, of course, for example, in the United States, Federal Reserve. And in the United States, the Federal Reserve notes that you carry around, if you have actual those pieces of cotton in your wallet, those are Federal Reserve notes. Those are expressions of central bank liability. But they generally filter through the commercial banking system. These would be coming directly from the central bank. However, a private bank digital currency. So the idea that, for example, the Federal Reserve says, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to track what you're doing. Don't worry about that. We're not going to put stipulations on it. The private banks will give the private banks the ability to issue their own digital currencies, and we'll just be sort of the stamp of authority on it, but we're not going to track you or any of that sort of stuff. The private banks will do all of that. But wait, who's regulating the entire banking system? Oh, like the FDIC, for example, in the United States, right? But wait, isn't that the exact way that the Obama administration and Biden and other administrations since then have limited, tracked, surveilled, debanked various people? Not directly. Not, of course, it wasn't Obama's Treasury Department that was doing that. They just leaned on the banks to do that for them through their regulatory power, for example, with the FDIC. So a private bank system is not necessarily going to be any better. And I'm afraid that some people are going to be placated when they hear, oh, good, no CBDCs in America. I guess we're free. Well, not necessarily.
So I could see some restrictions like that flying, maybe, if the public was all in on it and they thought, oh, no, our kids are going to be killed by CO2 if we don't accept these restrictions. But Gallup just came out with a poll, and they said, out of these seven environmental issues, which is your top one? And again, the whole climate change scam thing finished seventh of seven. So how the U.S. public is not going to take this. Maybe public elsewhere will. But any thoughts on that?
I sincerely hope so. And I think we've made some major strides towards that in recent years, because I think it's interesting to note, I deal with a lot of controversial subject matter in the podcast that I've been doing now since 2007. So now nearly 20 years of doing this. And when I first started the podcast, I thought it was going to be my controversial geopolitical takes about false flag terrorism and 9/11 truth and things like that, which would garner the most pushback from people out there in the audience. People will hate that. They'll be so angry. But actually, over the years, the thing that I have received probably the second most amount of pushback of anything I talk about is man-made global warming. Of course, how could you possibly question this? This is settled science. And you must be funded by the oil companies if you possibly cast any doubt about it, et cetera, et cetera. I've received a lot of pushback on that over the years. However, I will note that certainly in the last 4 or 5 years, some people in my audience who really, really hated my global warming take have started to think, you know, maybe, just maybe, it is possible that scientists are not floating on a cloud completely objectively and just looking at the rational data behind everything. Maybe they are influenceable, and maybe they have their own political agenda. And maybe when they say, I am the science and you can't question me, and yet they were wrong about everything they're saying, maybe they've been wrong about other things too. So I've noted, I've even had some emails from people who said, you know, I thought you were crazy. I wrote you off because of what you said about global warming. But, you know, actually in the last year or two, I've started to reconsider. So I have had some emails about that. And that is the most gratifying thing I can hear, because that is so essential. Once again, the most effective way to control society is to get people to believe in the validity of whatever authority is trying to control them, to volitionally want to actually put their sovereignty into some other person or into some other entity, to trust the science or trust the experts. To the extent that we can break that trust and show people, actually, you know, it might not be good to give away your individual sovereignty to these outside bodies, because they might not have your best interests in mind. To the extent that we can do that, I think we've accomplished something of note. But I did say that was my second most amount of pushback. Would you like to know what I have received the most pushback about?
I would.
I think humans are good. I think humans are not a cancer on this planet. I think we don't need fewer humans on this planet. I think we can have even more humans on this planet. And in fact, growing the human population is not only an inherent good, but also, I think, even if you're a utilitarian, I think it will result in better results in the long run, because I've listened to people like Julian Simon and others who have laid out the truth that the ultimate resource is not copper or zinc or anything else that you can imagine that's extracted from the ground. No, it is the space between our ears. The human brain is the greatest ultimate resource on this planet, and more humans is better. You will not, well, maybe you would believe how much negative feedback I receive about that message. Oh my God, how can you possibly say that? Humans are a cancer on this earth. And I definitely haven't been programmed to believe that by all of this propaganda that I've received since the time I was in school. No, no, it's definitely me who's saying this, James. Anyway, that to me is mind-blowing, because what better way could you possibly have that? Imagine if you were in the position that you wanted to reduce the human population. What better way than to get people to voluntarily, willingly, actually hate their own species, desire their own extinction? It's unimaginable that any other species could be made to do so. But somehow or other, humans have been made to desire their own extinction. I find that absolutely alarming, surprising, weird. But as you say, I think fewer and fewer people are falling for that propaganda right now. And anything that I can do to put the brakes on that agenda, I am doing my level best to do.
I think there are so many people on Earth that think there's too many of you on Earth and just the right amount of me on Earth.
That's yeah.
Very common.
I'm tempted to say you first to the people who say there are too many people and some need to go, but I don't even believe that. I don't want to see people actually harming themselves or killing themselves or anything like that. I want people to thrive and to realize that humans are a net good on this planet.
So getting back to the climate thing, I'm a little embarrassed as I was researching you to realize how far back your climate realism has gone, that you were digging into Climate Gate and talking about the IPCC and then talking to Tim Ball a lot, a long time ago, over and over. I don't know, you must have done many interviews with Tim Ball. You went to his house and hung around with him. Amazing.
That's right.
I'm curious as to how connected climate skeptics are, because I knew of you, but I didn't know that history at all. Had you heard of me before recently?
I absolutely have. Yes, okay. I have. You know, I found it interesting over the years that I haven't really connected with a lot of the people right. in the climate skeptic community. What a stupid word. But I find that interesting because, yes, I have been talking about this for nearly 20 years and I have connected with certain people in those areas. But then I don't know, there's some sort of wall, again, probably because I talk about matters political and geoeconomic and all of these other things. And I think people just think there might be too much baggage there. How could they talk to someone like that? Anyway, I'm happy to talk to whoever wants to listen to this message, because I know this message is incredibly important. And as you say, I managed to connect with Tim Ball very early on. I want to say maybe even 2007 when I started. He was one of the first guests I talked to when I was interviewing people. And I'm very, very glad to have made that connection, because as you say, in 2009, I managed to actually meet up with him in person. He took me on a walking tour of Victoria and showed me, and he was such a fount of knowledge on matters historical and philosophical. And we had this deep conversation about the history of philosophy and science and his true passion for science. And one of the things that he said to me in that conversation that will always resonate and stick with me is that he thought probably the greatest travesty of all of this climate nonsense that we're living through is he said, ultimately, when people realize the extent to which they've been lied to, it will undermine science itself. And I think he's right about that, because, again, as I say, the trust in science, the trust in authority has been broken, and for good reason, because we have been lied to. But it didn't have to be this way. And I think Tim Ball felt the tragedy of that.
Yeah, I think so many people have woken up, and just in the last 4 or 5 years, I've had so many people say that because of the whole COVID thing, and they're questioning everything else. You're seeing a lot of that too, as well. That you're people are more open to all the stuff that you're talking about now, I would guess, than 5 years ago.
Yes, absolutely. And you know what? I would say most of my audience has been on board with conspiratorial subject matter, and oh, don't look over there. But as I say, the global warming thing was one of the biggest barriers in a lot of people's minds, because I think that trust in the holy white robes of the climate scientists, how could they be lying to us? That seemed to be the last domino for a lot of people. But as you say, the last several years have, I think, taught people that scientists are also politically motivated, financially motivated, and otherwise, and sometimes just plain wrong. And now that people can see that, well, now they're starting to think a little more deeply about the climate narrative.
You must be getting a lot of new people who were not receptive to listening to your stuff, and now they are listening to what you're saying about geoengineering and all this, correct?
Well, I was getting a lot more attention until YouTube decided that, oh, he's saying things that he shouldn't be saying. He's questioning health authorities, and we can't have that on YouTube. So I had a channel of 600,000 subscribers that was turned off overnight, and all of those people, well, not all of them, but a large majority of them, that James Corbett guy, I used to know him, I wonder whatever happened to him. And just like that, a lot of people can lose track of you, which again is one of the travesties of all of this, because people have been conditioned into thinking that the internet is YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, that is the internet. No. I haven't been censored off the internet. I was censored off of YouTube. That is a very, very small subsection of the internet. But unfortunately, for a lot of people, that essentially means I'm gone. And so although, yes, I certainly was achieving quite a bit of success and reaching a lot of new people in 2020 into 2021, since that point, I don't know. Have I plateaued? I'm not sure. I don't even know how to exactly measure the metric. I'm still out there. I'm still producing content, but I have no good way of knowing whether that's growing or not.
So Grok said that you are censored on Spotify. Is that an error or is that true?
It may be true. As far as I know, I still have content on Spotify. All I know is I posted my RSS feed there, and I believe it auto-propagates. However, Spotify has given me notices recently about taking down a bunch of old episodes because they had snippets of music in them, and oh my God, you can't do that. So I don't know. I don't use Spotify at all myself, so someone out there can tell me whether I'm censored on Spotify or not.
Is Rumble the best place to go to see you on video?
I would say CorbettReport.com is the best place to go because, once again, I think it's important for... it's weird to me because, again, growing up in with the internet, the World Wide Web in the 90s, and then starting my own website in 2007, back when people used to have their own website and people used to use RSS feeds, does anyone remember really simple syndication? The way the internet is supposed to work, you take a feed reader, which is an open source program you can get from anywhere, and you decide to subscribe. Oh, I'll subscribe to that feed. I like that guy. Oh, that's a good blog. Oh, I like that guy's videos. You tailor your own feed, and there's no middleman. There's no Twitter. There's no YouTube. There's no third-party big tech conglomerate getting in between you and the content you want. That's the way the internet is supposed to work. But somehow we've all been conditioned into, no, you just go to some website and you give them all your information and you tell them who you want to follow, and then they decide whether or not you can follow that person. That is the biggest wrong turn I think we've taken in the internet era.
I kind of forgot. RSS was my kind of a go-to thing to find new content, and I forgot that.
It still is for me, but I know 99.9% of the public doesn't even remember RSS at this point.
How about X or Noster? You don't participate there?
I was on Twitter many years ago. I decided to get off because it was just a horrible place, a time suck. It was also not even valuable in terms of getting traffic to my website. When I actually looked at the stats, I realized very few people actually click through the links. So it was just a total waste of my time. Noster, I'm at least more interested in Noster because, again, I think it works a little bit more like the decentralized peer-to-peer internet is supposed to work. Having said that, I am not really keen on social media at all. And if I didn't have a website, I wouldn't be anywhere near any sort of social media. It's just that I have to promote my work. So I guess I have to appear on these various platforms. But I really do not like the social media conversations that go on. I think, honestly, I do believe the societal conversation is being dumbed down. And I think it is, I think that a lot of these platforms are contributing to that. And at this point, now I'm fighting the TikTokification of everything. People whose mind glazes over if they have more than 2 minutes of content to go through. Oh my God, I can't keep my attention on something that long. I'm not even going to try to fight that fight at this point.
So X has plenty of flaws, but now you don't have to post a link and hope people click on it. Now you can put a long form article right out there and people can read it right there. Yeah. And the same deal with videos. You can post long form or clips or whatever right on X. So I would still love to see you out there. But isn't there somebody that's reposting your stuff already automatically? Or are you okay if people do that?
There probably is. I always say, hey, if people want to repost my stuff, go for it. Just don't claim to be me. Because unfortunately, some people do on some of these platforms try to claim, oh, it is the Corbett Report. And that obviously is not a good thing. But as long as people say, I'm not really the Corbett Report, this is unofficial, then I'm happy for anyone to repost whatever I do.
Yeah, I think that's great that if people are fans of you, if they can take some time and put clips and stuff, put quotes, sure, and say, and then in the replies, they can point people to your site.
I'm censored on YouTube, but I know there are other people who take my work and put it on YouTube, and they're fine for whatever reason, so go for it.
Your channel is totally gone, and you don't put anything up there, is that correct, on YouTube?
Absolutely nothing. No, yes, I had two channels. I had the main channel and the backup channel. They both got censored in 2021. The main channel is still gone. The backup channel magically and weirdly reappeared in 2022 or 2023, I can't remember, out of the blue one day. I didn't even get a notification from YouTube about it. No email, nothing. It just suddenly was there. And so I posted up a video to say, I am never, ever, 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 ever posting to YouTube ever again. Do not look here for my content. I am not posting it here. But I no one will ever see that, unfortunately.
So what are you currently working on just like this week or this month? What's taking up a lot of your work time or your concentration?
Well, actually, I guess, again, on the scientific theme, although slightly different than the climate science, I am working on a report about the weaponization of psychology, specifically how psychology has been weaponized to pathologize dissent, political dissent, and the way that people who have contrarian takes on matters political or scientific or otherwise are labeled crazy. That's a crazy idea. And of course, that's just the figure of speech until it isn't. And I talk about some of the people who have actually, for example, been forcibly committed for their political beliefs, etc. This is a well-known phenomenon that's happened for throughout history, really. But of course, back in the 70s and 80s, there was a big brouhaha about the Soviets. They're weaponizing psychiatry against the dissidents in the Soviet Union. And there was sluggish schizophrenia and these other labels that were being applied to dissidents, obviously forcibly confined and drugged, etc., in the Soviet Union. But it also happens in the land of the free and in the West as well. And I think it's a worrying trend that we have to be on guard against, because unfortunately, as much as people have woken up to various scientific scams, I think there's still a lot of belief in psychological woo-woo out there that does not really stand up to scientific scrutiny. Obviously, for example, the replication crisis was first pointed out in the psychological field, where whatever the exact stat was, over 50% of psychological papers could not be repeated. Well, that's something kind of strange going on in that area, isn't it? And something that bears a little bit more scrutiny. And then when you start to realize that the Bible of the American Psychiatric Association, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, is a creation of committees who, by the way, large portions of many of the members of the constituent committees are either directly on the payroll of Big Pharma or are indirectly on the payroll of Big Pharma. And they literally invent diseases or disorders that they then diagnose and then prescribe medicines for. You start to realize that there is a bigger racket going on. And just as one example of that, back in DSM, I believe it was DSM-4, they decided to call oppositional defiant disorder a new type of psychological disorder. What is ODD? It's essentially children who dislike authority. Are ODD, oppositional defiant disorder. And what do you do with a child who dislikes authority? You drug them, of course. And that leads to some of the absurdly high rates of medication and prescription for even children in the United States, which I really think is a travesty and something that I think people should just generally be very concerned about. So I'm looking at that entire process and how such a system really gets ensconced in positions of institutional power. There's a fascinating story to be told there. So I'm really digging into that. That's going to be a pretty lengthy report that's going to be coming out hopefully in the next couple of weeks. And oh, by the way, I just finished a book that I've been working on for the last 15 years. It's called Reportage, Essays on the New World Order. And it covers all of the types of topics that I cover in my regular work, including climate science. I have an essay on the strange life of Morris Strong. And I'm sure most of your audience is familiar with Morris Strong, but if not, there's a lot of biographical information in there that should give people pause for thought. I've just recently written that book, and it's so far doing quite well. And I'm going to have a book launch in Osaka next month. So I hope if there's anyone out there in Japan, come along to the book launch.
So you mentioned that you get a lot of your information from your RSS feed. Whose work do you really like, or do you listen to podcasts or read certain authors more than others? Or
yes, I cast my net widely, and I'm always changing and tinkering with my feed. But some stalwarts, people that I'm constantly talking to or talking with or reading or interacting with, would include, for example, every week I do a news show called New World Next Week with my co-host James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com. I interact frequently with The Last American Vagabond, Ryan Christian. Whitney Webb is someone who wrote the foreword, for example, for my book, and that I've talked to quite frequently. There's a number of people like that, Derek Brose and others that I follow. Again, I cast my net pretty widely when it comes to looking at information, because I want to get information from a number of different perspectives, because I tend to think that there is no such thing as objective reporting. I think all reporting comes with some measure of subjectivity to it. I'm no exception. I'm a person with my own beliefs and my own perspective, and I have my own way of looking at the world. And that's necessarily going to influence my work, if by nothing else than just the process of selection. What stories am I interested in talking about? What stories do I know nothing about? What stories am I going to ignore? What sources do I turn to? All of that, again, comes from a position of subjectivity. And I think the way to combat that problem of subjectivity, if we want to look at it as a problem, is to cast our net widely and look at many different sources. And I tend to think that the information that you can triangulate from a number of different sources tends to be the more reliable information.
So getting back to the climate thing, skeptics like me are accused of being funded by big oil. Can you explain in layman's terms why big oil is not fighting the climate scam, or they're kind of pushing the climate scam?
Yes. As you saw in that How and Why Big Oil Conquered the World documentary, yes, I've been accused of being funded by big oil, too. In fact, the DeSmog blog had a post up about me and my ClimateGate.tv, which I started over a decade ago. And look at this. I've got a TV channel now. This must be well funded. It was literally a website that I started with, $5 a month or whatever the hosting fees for the website was. So that should right there tell you everything you need to know about the DeSmog blog and people like that. But anyway, yes, the oil companies, I suppose we have to differentiate between the oil companies themselves and the oil tycoons and monopolists of the early oil industry. So, for example, when we think of oil, we still think of families like the Rockefellers, and obviously the incredible stranglehold of the entire oil economy that Standard Oil enjoyed in the early part of the 20th century, until the Standard Oil monopoly was broken up, which made Rockefeller even richer, actually. And what did Rockefeller do with those riches? The important thing for people to wrap their minds around was that for the oil tycoons and monopolists.
Sorry, this is Tom breaking in to speak the next line for James because it got lost in the recording. James said, "It wasn't about the oil itself. It was about the power that comes from the monopolization of a core resource of the economy."
And if that power can be used and wielded in ways that even go against the oil industry itself, that those people who are interested in power will do so. And that is, I think that's the way we have to understand. The Rockefellers have divested from oil now. So I guess the Rockefellers are on the side of Mother Nature now. Well, there's, I think, complications to that story. And ultimately, as I say, I think that the 21st century variation of that ruling oligarchy narrative that we've been sold throughout human history, the 21st century variation of that is technocracy. And I think we're seeing that change over now, perhaps best exemplified by the Saudis and this idea that suddenly the Saudis are pouring all their money into NEOM, the city of the future. They're going to build this incredible technological future city out in the desert with all of their oil money, because oil is the thing of the past. They're going to convert it into all of this technology that they're going to wield and use and ultimately start to extract. Data is the new oil, as you may have heard in recent years. And so I think there is a changeover in the economy that is being planned and being brought about by some of the very same people who were the oil monopolists and the oil tycoons and the people who made their fortune in oil. So, yes, oil companies still exist and presumably still have their interest in oil itself. But I think the people who were the benefits of the largesse of those oil companies have moved on to other ventures, and in some cases are directly moving against the oil industry as it existed in the past. As evidence of which, I will cite, for example, who was in favor of the 2015 Paris Accords. It was BP and other oil company executives coming out in favor of the Paris Climate Accords. Why was that? Why would they be interested in hampering their own industry? It's almost as if oil monopolists have always known that scarcity has always been good for their product because it always drives the price up. So to the extent that they can make it so there will be less oil, but the economy still runs on oil, so you'll be paying more, essentially. But secondarily, because they are planning for this green transition, which of course will never quite arrive, but boy, are they spending trillions and trillions trying to make these carbon markets and other things happen. again, for the largesse of the people at the very top of the system, not for the average company executive or what have you, but the people who are calling the shots at the higher levels.
So what do you think is going on among insiders at the UN, EU, and even Big Pharma? Do you think they're sitting around thinking it's going really well, or are they looking at the polling and stuff and thinking this is not working out? This is not going the way we thought it would.
Yeah, I would imagine. Let me put it this way. I don't think that there is some sort of coordinated, monolithic conspiracy that every single person is assigned card-carrying member of, or that everyone's reading from some script and doing whatever they're told. I'm sure there are a lot of true believers at every level of this who really, truly believe in the climate narrative and what they're doing, et cetera, et cetera. But yes, as you say, looking around at the way things are going at the moment, I would imagine a lot of them are at the very least concerned about the direction things are heading, because people are starting to reject their narratives and people are starting to question this. Things that 10, 15, 20 years ago would have been inviolable are suddenly viable. So, for example, I mean, just the idea, well, we're going to tell people to live in 15-minute cities. We live in their little pods. You'll own nothing and be happy. You'll eat the bugs. These, I don't understand why the peasants are getting uppity about this. Let them eat bugs. Yeah, it's not working out for them on a propagandistic level in the way that it used to. To me, actually, I'm very, very glad that they are stuck in this idea of trying to sell these stupid narratives to the public, because yeah, some people will go along with it, but a lot of people are waking up to it. And to me, the way I envision this is like when I started doing podcasting in 2007, that was at the time when, you will remember, the people on TV, the important people, used to laugh. Oh, where did you hear that? On the internet? Well, those very same people are now flocking to Substack and other places trying to survive as the old media companies start to implode, because everyone gets their information from the internet now. And the dinosaur media are finally realizing that the comet struck 20 years ago and they're just trying to pick up the pieces right now. I think there's a similar moment happening with the whole UN globalist idea and agenda and the climate narrative and all of that. And I don't know, I liked the days, you know, back 20 years ago when they used to laugh at people like me. Oh, you're this crazy internet person, because they didn't take it seriously. But I knew no one who is currently under the age of, say, 40 or 50, no one was listening to CNN and the talking heads on TV. Well, it's the same thing right now. No one who there's just a certain demographic. There's no one who's actually listening to Klaus Schwab and the UN people and taking them seriously. But it's better when they don't realize that, because then they'll continue putting out this stupid, ludicrous propaganda that's quite easy to tear apart. I'm more concerned when they start refining their propaganda and getting it working again in the minds of the public. That will be a more intimidating thing to worry about.
What sort of thinking do you think went into this, having Klaus Schwab with his accent saying you are going to eat the bugs to prevent bad weather? Is that, why did they think that, did they seriously think that was going to fly and we're going to start eating the bugs to prevent bad weather? What were they thinking?
I guess the Davos crowd tends to be European, or at least Eurocentric, so perhaps that doesn't jar as much. But yeah, I think to North Americans, listening to the Bond villain himself delivering these pronouncements is a bit laughable. But perhaps it makes more sense when you realize that Klaus Schwab was a Henry Kissinger protege, and perhaps people thought, oh, Kissinger. People used to take him seriously and, oh, he's a man with a lot of gravitas simply because he spoke in that accent, which I have heard. I don't know. I've certainly never heard it, but I've heard that was a bit of an affectation. He lived in America most of his life. He didn't really talk like that. But when he talked like that, people would take him seriously because he talked like some sophisticated foreigner. Maybe they thought the similar thing could work with someone like Schwab, but he is just too much of a caricature for anyone to take seriously at this point.
So switching gears here, what do you think about the whole money printing thing? We have all this debt in the U.S. and can Bitcoin in some way fix any of this?
Well, can it fix this? Well, I guess the question is, what are people attempting to fix? And for me, for example, I did a documentary on the history of the Federal Reserve. It's called Century of Enslavement, and you could watch it, CorbettReport.com/Federal Reserve, where I talk about essentially the history of not just the Federal Reserve, really central banking in the United States from its inception, where certain forces were very keen on getting a central bank installed to steward over the U.S. economy. And there was the First Bank of the United States and the Second Bank of the United States. And then ultimately, 1913, you get the Federal Reserve. And what that was the cartelization of the money printing power, which, I don't know, at least constitutionally was supposed to be the power of Congress. But they have now ceded that over to this banking entity. And so there's a cartel, essentially, that's stewarding over the money printing power. And that is the real power of society. That is the power to determine which way an economy goes, whether it's growing or shrinking, and which industries will win, which industries will lose. That is the real center of power. So to my mind, the idea of cryptocurrency was the promise of circumventing the central bankers altogether and getting past that system. We do not need a central bank intermediary stewarding over the money supply, because that is always throughout history, it has always been used for funding wars of aggression and, of course, paying off and blackmailing and bribing people who otherwise may even think about throwing some sort of wrench in the works or something. Unfortunately, the way cryptocurrency has developed since the Bitcoin white paper in 2009 has not really lived up to that promise or potential, precisely because, unfortunately, at this point, it is seen primarily as an investment. And it strikes me that if you are measuring the price of Bitcoin in dollars, that kind of completely, ultimately undermines the entire purpose of cryptocurrency. No. When dollars are measured in Bitcoin, that's when we realize that there has been a true revolution that's taken place. But unfortunately, I don't think people are thinking in those terms, and people don't really, most people in the crypto space at this point do not understand what crypto is really about. It isn't about just getting more dollars. It is about circumventing the central banks themselves. We do not need intermediaries in the money supply. Until people understand that and understand the meaning of that, I don't think any true revolution will occur.
Okay, another unrelated question is, Lewis Brackpool just came out with a tweet today saying, now the UK government is preparing to approve geoengineering experiments aimed at dimming the sun. So any thoughts on that? Are we at the point now where they denied it for so long and now they're just admitting this is an actual thing?
Absolutely. In fact, it's not even the first time that they've come out with this pronouncement. We've been hearing this exact same pronouncement for years and years and years and years now. And I can think back to David Keith, who was originally at the University of Calgary, which was my alma mater. Then he went to Harvard, has been talking about this for decades at this point. There was a lot of coverage 5, 6, 7 years ago when Bill Gates is going to block out the sun. So this is one of those stories that keeps coming out. Interestingly, exactly like I find it fascinating to note, and I hope other people will note this. Every single time you ever read a story in this CNN or the BBC or whatever outlet comes out with it about cloud seeding, there's this amazing, incredible new technology that has never been tried or heard of before in your life, where they can actually seed clouds and make it rain. And it's so bizarre to me, because this is almost century-old technology at this point, and I have seen that exact story year after year after year, and they always introduce it as if it's a brand new technology you've never heard of before. I don't even understand that level of propaganda, but anyway, this strikes me like that. They keep announcing, we're going to start thinking about maybe testing, spraying things in the sky to dim the sun or something like that. We might do that in the future, maybe, if we think about it really hard. Meanwhile, I wonder what all those lines in the sky are. Anyway, I'm a crazy conspiracy theorist.
All right, we're coming up to the end of our hour here. Anything else you want to cover before we finish up?
I think we have covered an awful lot of territory. So I'm struggling to think of what else we should or could cover. But I would say, again, I would invite people to check out CorbettReport.com, because it is a now nearly 20-year repository of information on this. And all of my audio and video and textual media is available there. directly from my servers. So you don't have to go to any platform in order to get it if you don't want to. And I would encourage people to use it as the resource it is. It was designed and intended to be an open source resource. Who the hell am I? I'm just some random guy in Japan who's sitting here in his living room. What do I know about anything? Don't listen to me. Go and take a look at the information I provide specifically in show notes, references, footnotes. I always try to source where I'm getting information from. So when I talk about the Technocracy study course and things like this, don't take it from me. Go and read it for yourself. Because I know from my own personal experience, it wasn't until I started looking up the primary source documents on these sorts of things that I was finally able to break through the propagandistic barriers that had been erected around me since childhood and realize, oh, there's a much, much bigger story going on here. And so I always encourage people to go back to source material and to use my work as the resource that it is, just to, if nothing else, just to find primary source documents on these sorts of subjects.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to buy your book right now that I see behind you. And can you say the name again? Because you said it before. How do you correctly pronounce the name of that book?
It is Reportage, Essays on the New World Order. I'm Canadian, so you know it's got to be fancy schmancy French-Canadian kind of sound.
All right, thanks a ton for taking the time. I really enjoy your work and hope to talk to you later.
Excellent, anytime. Thank you.